Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Two White Queens and the One-Eyed Jack by Heidi von Palesque, narrated by Heidi von Palesque. To the first twins in my life, Mother Doreen and Aunt Colleen, born of rape and full of rage and life, and to their mother, my grandmother Vera, who was a warrior woman all the days of her life, even though her youth was stolen at 16 years old, and to my daughter Kavanaugh, who is brave enough to speak out and claim her voice, to all the daughters of rape, the cycle ends here. The eye sees only what the mind is prepared to comprehend. Robertson Davies. 1. He was there when Johnny fell from the tree. The crack of the branch, that double sound, a crack-crack warning before the final, disappointing snap. Then, the slow-motion tumble through the air as the wood gave way. A slow-motion pantomime where the force of a turbo engine wouldn't be quick enough. He twisted and spiraled, taking leaves and twigs along with him. Those were the only sounds. The snaps, the cracks, and the rustles. Then finally, the thud of his body touching down. Hadn't they been warned about climbing? That smothering, mothering voice.
Val, don't come crying to me if you break your necks.
But that hadn't discouraged them. After Gareth emerged the climbing victor up to the tippy top and down again, it was Johnny's turn. Higher, higher, Gareth called out. Johnny, being light and adept, was only too happy to comply, until the top branches could not bear his weight. Surely it was not high enough to break his neck. It was only a few feet over their heads. An oversized bush, really, a hawthorn, Gareth thought. But perhaps that's just because of the word thorn following ha ha ha. But no one was laughing. No one ever laughed, and no one ever mentioned how Gareth had called Johnny a scaredy cat that hot afternoon. The scream sent Gareth running. After an initial pause of frozen realization, his legs moved on their own until he was nothing but pounding heart and pounding feet, faster and faster across the field, over the fence, past the barn to the driveway, and up the newly painted steps.
Gareth, I told you, I just painted those!
Johnny's mother, Hilda, shrieked, but one look at Gareth's face, and she began running in the direction from which he had just come. Finally, Gareth just stood there, catching his breath, squeezing his eyes, willing it all to go away. He didn't go back to the tree that day, didn't want to see the blood or his screaming friend clutching his eye. He turned his face toward home, to the understanding embrace of his mother.
Good thing it was his bad eye, his older brother Tristan declared when Gareth delivered the awful news.
What do you mean, Trist? Their mother asked. Tristan regarded his mother with the weak disdain that only firstborns possess. He tossed back his mass of blonde curls and planted his feet squarely, hands on his hips. His knowing look to his younger brother, then his inhalation followed by a slow exhaled sigh, all pointed to the fact that he had been alive an entire year and a half longer than Gareth. He knew things. He knew all sorts of things.
Well, if he can still see, then he only hurt the lazy eye. It's not the eye that does all the work.
Then Tristan took his hand and covered one eye, and then the other, to make his point. You know, try it. See? Can't see. See? Can't see. And so, on one hot day at the start of June, Gareth's best friend lost an eye to a thorn bush, and it was discovered that Gareth's older brother was blind in one of his. It was far easier dealing with his brother's blind eye than his friend's. Nothing had really changed for Gareth's brother, after all. Tristan didn't think twice about it. He was used to being monocular, having had single-eye vision since birth. Sure, their parents fretted over it, but deep down, Gareth knew that nothing had changed for Tristan that day. He was blind in his left eye when he woke up, and still blind in his left eye when he went to bed. Besides, the dud eye functioned as though it were a seeing eye. It moved as the good eye moved, following the stronger twin, never letting on that it was, in any way, less. But Johnny was another story. His new eye was, for the most part, unmoving.
It was freaky how it sometimes stayed, staring blindly ahead, while the other did as it pleased with no regard for the replacement eye. Gareth assumed that his friend's old eye hated the new one. It must have missed its matching eye and begrudged the new eye's placement in his friend's head. Johnny underwent surgeries and procedures throughout that entire summer. An enucleation to remove the eye happened just days after the accident, and Johnny was required to wear a patch to cover where the eye had been. Gareth didn't understand why the eye had to come out, why they didn't just let it get better. His eye always got better when he accidentally poked it. Sure, this was worse, but why not give it a chance? Well, Gareth, his eye had too much damage. They had to take the eye out because if they didn't, then he could go blind in the other eye, Johnny's mom explained to him carefully with her deep, strange voice. Why? He didn't hurt the other eye.
It's a strange thing that happens. When one eye goes blind, sometimes the brain gets all mixed up, and then the other eye goes blind too, especially if it's kids,
Hilda explained as though she, too, didn't quite believe it. She had wanted to wait and see. Perhaps his eye would be fine, but the surgeon had been insistent, so she sat outside the surgery door. She waited. Even when her husband suggested that they go have a coffee, that they should take a break, Hilda stayed behind, feeling those first pains of separation. How could she leave her son to those consoling strangers with their sharp scalpels?
But my brother is blind in one eye, and the other one didn't go blind.
That is because he didn't suffer a trauma. It's different. She wanted to let it drop, not wanting Gareth to feel responsible for the accident, not wanting to remember. Eventually, the patch came off and Johnny was allowed out to play. He had a pair of glasses on, for protection. Gareth stared at his friend in shock. It wasn't the strangeness of sudden glasses that bothered him. It was that the bad eye had been replaced with something that seemed to have a drawing of an eye on it. Unmoving, hard, and just a little bit creepy.
Not catch, Gareth. What if that baseball hits Johnny in the eye?
But you can look at comic books together. I got the new Spider-Man one for the both of you.
Gareth didn't know if Johnny's mom was more worried about the fake eye or the seeing eye. If the ball hit the seeing eye and Johnny got a shiner, then he wouldn't be able to see at all, not till the swelling went down. But what if it hit the fake eye? Gareth imagined shards shooting out of his friend's eye socket, like the crystal vase that had slid from his hands when he was helping with the washing up. Hundreds of sharp little splinters that cut into his hurrying fingers as he tried to pick it all up before anyone noticed.
We want his eye to get better, don't we, Gareth?
Johnny's mother asked, her W sounding more like V's than the way other mothers said words starting with the letter W. Gareth nodded. Of course he wanted the eye to get better, but he knew deep in his belly that the eye wouldn't get better. It would never see again. Gareth wondered why Johnny's mother didn't know that as well. Gareth's feet didn't quite touch the ground. They dangled somewhere between the seat and the floor. He swung them back and forth, counting how many times each foot passed the other. Why did he have to go to the eye doctor with his brother again? Boring, boring, boring.
You could color. There are coloring books and crayons over there,
his father Mark suggested, hoping Gareth would settle down. Gareth scowled, his full bottom lip in a petulant pout. How many times did he have to explain to his dad that he only colors the things he draws himself? Whoever drew those many pictures in the fat paper book should color his own stuff.
I'm not coloring someone else's stupid pictures. Gareth's young sense of justice was slighted at the suggestion he should do someone else's work.
Higher, higher. He suddenly remembered his words and his stomach clenched, reliving his friend's fall from the tree. He knew it was all his fault, and yet he still resented all the attention Johnny was getting. At least his brother's eye problems weren't his fault.
Go on, you're almost there. Don't be a scaredy cat.
Gareth put his hands over his ears, but it didn't quiet the voice in his head, and so his leg swinging took on more vigor until every exchange was punctuated by the whish, whish, whish sound of corduroy ribs rubbing violently against each other. It was only when the two matching girls walked in that Gareth stopped counting the swings of his legs. His hands dropped from his ears, and he could not help but ask out loud, "What are they?" His father swatted him on the thigh to make him hush. "Tristan?" The woman in the white pants, the white coat, and the white shoes spoke his brother's name as she opened the door, separating those waiting from whatever strange happenings might be occurring inside beyond the barrier. On each previous appointment, Gareth was invited in to join them, but he always shook his head no. He had glimpsed the large machines and could only imagine the torture his brother had to face. It was bad enough that he would have to see his brother's dilated pupils. Tristan and their father went through the magical doors, leaving Gareth in the presence of the two white girls. He waved awkwardly at them, his hand doing that childlike side-to-side gesture that is always accompanied by a courageous, unnatural smile, a smile of hope, a smile that says, "I made the first move. Do not humiliate me by not mimicking it back." But the girls took no notice of him. They just talked to each other in whispers. He couldn't quite make out the words, but what snippets he did hear were gibberish to him, a foreign language from some faraway place. "Den snippet up some blondish boy? Yes, him den snippet good and still." They seemed the color of snow, with straight hair that blended in with their skin, so that you couldn't tell where their foreheads ended and the soft downy strands of their hair began. And downy they were, with hair more like gosling's feathers than actual hair, pulling off their faces and into tight, long white braids, each secured with a blue bauble band popping out violently from a sea of white. Behind their thick glasses, Gareth could just catch a glimpse of pink eyes, circled by thick, snowy lashes. The pink oval started side to side quickly. He looked from one twin to the other and, yes, both girls had pink eyes, with dark reddish-black pupils moving back and forth and back and forth, rapidly in small, slightly jittery movements. "Bunny eyes," he thought. "Scared bunnies, like the ones Johnny's mother had in Hutch's. Pets, until they vanished, only to show up skinned and headless in the freezer." Gareth glanced at the coloring books. They were so close to the pale creatures. If he could only pretend to want one, he could creep closer and get a better look, figure out who and what they really were. "Don't stare," an old man bellowed in his direction. "Not polite to stare." The old man turned his attention to the girls, swatted them both on their backs, and ordered that they sit up straight. The girls improved their posture, straightened their backs, and tried to focus their vibrating pink eyes in front of themselves.
I just wanted a coloring book," Gareth stammered.
"Oh, for Christ's sakes, they don't bite. Get off your hiney and get one. Clara, hand this idiot a coloring book."
One of the matching creatures reached over and picked up a book. She brought it close to her face to her vibrating pink eyes and examined it. Then she discarded it. She picked up another and repeated the process. Each time she seemed to smile a bit more, enjoying the power she was building as she reached, lifted, examined, and discarded. Finally, she settled on the fourth book and, smiling broadly, held it to her chest as she crossed the waiting room floor before offering it to Gareth. It was only when he looked at the book with its missing cover that he understood her hidden message. There, flying amongst the flowers, was a pair of winged fairies. Outlines, no more, with uncolored insides as white as the girls looking over at him. Changelings. Switched at birth and expelled from the fairy world. Forced to live with the evil, fat old ogre. Gareth quickly glanced at the old man sitting there. White ribbed socks, patent leather shoes in black and white, Bermuda shorts, and a stained, improperly buttoned polyester shirt.
"You need some crayons with that, don't you?"
Gareth shook his head. The uncolored fairies were perfect just the way they were. The albino twins were ready and waiting. Their hair was combed and braided perfectly, their clothes matching, were their best dresses. They had put on fresh white knee socks. Even their shoes, Mary Jane's, were polished and shiny. After all, their mother was coming home for a visit, so everything had to be perfect. They saw her only intermittently, weekends mostly, when she was well enough to see them. On those days, they would ride in their uncle's second-hand station wagon with his fake wood sides and backward-facing seats. They always took those seats, looking at what had already been, what they were leaving behind. They would hold hands as they watched the scenery fall away from them, as they sped toward the little yellow cottages on the shores of Lake Ontario. Past Lynn Creek, where the swans and geese nested, beyond the Girl Guide camp, where city guides and brownies could experience the joys of nature away from their concrete lives, and then along a gravel road that wound past a small hospital and weaved benignly to the little yellow cottages. They thought it unfair that their mom got to stay there on her own, staring out of the water, while they were shuttled between disgruntled relatives. And worse, they had to go to school to learn things like how to lie low, how to seem invisible, and how to be deaf to the jokes made about them. What did she do there all day, their mother? Probably not much, since she said and did so little at home. Just stared ahead, counting the minutes. The only difference was that when she was home, the girls had to put a special effort into behaving. No fights, no bickering, and not too much noise. Then, only then, at the end of the day, she would come and kiss their foreheads, tuck them into bed, snug as a bug in a rug. Clara and Blanca thought of what it would be like if their mother never came home again, if she just decided to stay forever in her yellow cottage. Then they could be adopted by someone else, escape their reality and move far away from their grandfather with his ashtray of smokes, his greasy fry-ups, and his stinking farts. They could find new parents, a mother and a father who would be there every night when they got home from school, ready to help them with their studies while they sipped hot cocoa or tea. Maybe they could even be homeschooled, away from bullying nicknames, in the safe embrace of these new parents. The father would smoke a pipe and puff, puff, puff while he threw out words of wisdom or turned on his hi-fi to play something from his collection of records. And there would be a mother who baked cakes and pies, a mother who could sing like the dark-eyed woman who lived in the main floor apartment two floors below them. Yes, they would be perfect parents, the couple downstairs, Esther and David with their music and art. Imagine being tucked away in that mysterious lower apartment that smelled of wood polish, baking, and lavender. The twins did not have to say this to each other as they zoomed along. They knew what the other thought, and when one didn't, they had a secret language, a language that kept them safe. Blanca rubbed her foot along the colors. They were so intense that even she could differentiate between the reds and purples and golds. It was a woven garden with vines reaching past the flowers to the edges of the carpet, and all the way around there were fringes, tied rope or wool or whatever it was, stretching out along the shine of the polished hardwood floors. She took off her sandals, pressed her bare foot into the plush of the rug, felt the soft wool pile embrace her tiny foot. The two girls had been invited for tea in the downstairs apartment the day before when they came home, again, with downcast stares and pouting mouths because their mother hadn't come back with them. They hadn't even seen her. She'd had one of her episodes again and was in the big building being watched after a treatment. To the twins, it was just another disappointment that they could lock away in their treasury of childhood memories. And so, when Esther saw them, she gave them each a piece of poppy seed cake and told them to come by the next day for high tea. After church, she had said, and told them not to change out of their Sunday clothes. That's how the girls knew how special high tea had to be. Clara sat waiting, her tiny body trembling with anticipation. She'd never had high tea and didn't quite know what to expect. She only knew that manners were in tall order. It all sounded so special. As special as the pictures on the wall, they had to be special because there were huge gold frames around them. Clara got up from her chair and approached one of the paintings. As she got closer, she saw that it wasn't flat like the pictures they had in school and at the library. It had texture that seemed to swirl toward her. She wanted to get closer, to run her hand over the paint, feel the three dimensions. But then, when she got close, she realized that the woman in the painting was completely naked. Why? She wondered, didn't she put on her underwears before she was painted?
They had never been all the way inside the lower apartment before, only glimpsed what they could whenever the door was opened, always too quickly for the girl's curiosity. Still, they had seen things, knew that the first floor apartment was a world apart from the attic one their grandfather had. How could two apartments in the same big old house be so different, smell so different, but mostly sound so different? Clara looked over at the piano. It practically looked like another table, but higher up. She had never seen a piano so large and wide. She wanted to go touch it. She wanted to go to it, touch the keys with her sticky little fingers just to hear what sound it would make. She imagined stretching her small hands as wide as possible so she could play a chord. She wanted multiple notes all at once and for them to sound pleasant, resonant, and accomplished. "We can play the piano after tea," Esther Perlman announced. Clara knew she was found out, caught staring with a covetous eye at the instrument. Hopefully Mrs. Perlman wouldn't prefer her sister now like everyone else did.
"Clara wants to play the piano, but I want to sing," Blanca announced.
"Well, we can do both," Mrs. Perlman said, smiling. Gosh, she was wonderful, even if she had a funny way of pronouncing words.
"You know," she said, moving closer to the girls, confiding, "I used to practice both before I had to leave Hungary."
"I'm hungry," Clara blurted out, misunderstanding.
Esther took the cue and poured out the steaming tea from the gold-trim, fine white teapot and offered the girls each a plateful of cake.
"Eat as much as you like, but let's make sure we leave one piece for David when he gets home."
"Is David your husband?" Clara asked. Esther nodded.
"Why don't you have any children?" Blanca inquired.
"We were not blessed with children," Esther stated flatly, so that the girls would not know how that great regret lived within her every day of her life.
"I wish we could come here whenever we're sad," Clara blurted out, spitting crumbs across the table.
"Are you sad often?" asked Esther.
"Well, we're sad we have to go back to school soon. Everybody makes fun of us."
"Well, have some more cake, and let's not think of that for now. Come as often as you like during the summer and on weekends when you go back to school." Esther soothed and secretly thought, what strange little creatures they are. When summer ended, Johnny worried about going back to school. There would be real classes now, a full day from 9 till 3:30 with a lunch break and two recesses. There were so many new responsibilities that came with being 6. Lunch buckets with thermoses, different subjects, and paperwork to bring home almost every day. But Johnny didn't worry about any of those new responsibilities. He only worried that someone might make fun of his fake eye. It was not to be his final eye. Johnny's eye was a temporary conformer placed over the orb to fill in the roundness of the eye that had undergone enucleation. It was small, half an almond shell placed behind the eyelids to maintain an eye-like shape after the surgery. A match, as close as possible, hazel with a gray outline, was found in a drawer. And while the socket was healing, the fake stand-in seemed to ooze and crust over like a captive reindeer's weepy eyes. Of course, the infection came from somewhere deep within the cavern of the socket, far away from anything his classmates could ever see or imagine, but it seeped forth through every unfit space like spoiling leftovers in a Tupperware container with an ill-fitting lid. And so he began to cover it with his hand, hoping no one would notice it.
"Does it hurt, Johnny?"
She was a new teacher, fresh from college. She wore bright colors and lipstick on her ever-smiling mouth. Her voice was high and airy, like a cartoon, not a squeaky cartoon, but a princess in a cartoon, one of those drawings with the long spiraling curls and pointy boobs. Miss Argyle had both. The hair, an ash-blonde color, fell down to where the points began, and all of it was accentuated by the bright salmon or seafoam-colored cashmere twin sets she wore, a single strand of imitation pearls floating between the neck and the inevitable swell. Both Johnny and Gareth loved her right away and laughed when one or the other accidentally called her Mom.
"Does it hurt?"
Miss Argyle asked again as she reached out to touch his hand softly
as she moved it away from the unseeing eye.
No, ma'am.
Don't be ashamed of it. You had quite the ordeal. You know something? I think you're the bravest boy I've ever met. Your new eye is a badge of honor. You should never feel like you have to cover it.
At that moment, Gareth disliked his friend's new eye almost as much as he believed Johnny's good eye did.
Hilda tossed in her bed. Her prince lay in the next room asleep, his seeing eyes blind to the world now as his other eye. She knew it would be a restless night, knew that the only cure would be to pick herself up, move away from her husband, and creep into her boy's room. How much more sturdy her girls were, playing double dutch and clapping hands. What was that rhyme they sang over and over again? Miss Mary Mac, 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 all dressed in black, 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 with silver buttons, buttons, buttons. How much easier it was for this generation, protected by games and optimism, protected by a look to the future. Her girls faced life head on, both eyes open, but not her son, not him. Even when he had two eyes, he was always just a bit more hesitant. She opened his door, the knob whining under her grasp. She went in to have a look, peaceful and still. With eyes entirely closed, he looked normal to her, handsome, an angel, perfect, unmarred, and content. Did he dream with the perspective he once had, with two seeing eyes instead of just one? Hilda couldn't remember the last time she dreamed, or the last time she slept through the night. She had been avoiding sleep as much as she had once embraced it as a child. When she was young, no one ever had to suggest that it was bedtime to her. She would finish her evening meal and then take herself to bed, eager to experience the world of her imagination. She believed that her imaginary dream world was every bit as real and a lot more inviting than her waking world. She had been bullied when she was young, teased to try harder, go further. She had grown up in a small town just an hour drive outside of Hamburg, Bad Oldslow. Bad, not meaning naughty, but meaning bath. There were baths, old Roman baths, in the village, with steam rising from the concrete and the faint smell of sulfur. The baths were a greenish color, but healing. When she was a young girl, she went there with her mother and watched as her mother walked the perimeter of them, putting her hand on rocks or trees, as if invoking something, something so old and foreign to the new regime that had taken over, something beyond threats and politics and horrors. When her mother completed her ritual, Hilda felt safe and secure, protected, as though a circle had been drawn around her so strong and so invisible that nothing could ever penetrate it. Why hadn't she done the same for her own son? Why hadn't she drawn the protective circle for him so that the old gods could watch over him, gods who could have caught him when the branch broke to ease his fall? She secretly knew what had stopped her from practicing the old ways. Optimism. Yes, that was the obstacle. She had been seduced by hope, believing she was in a new world with a new chance and a new beginning. Surely the protection of old spirits had no place in Canada. Hilda stared at her one-eyed son in his Spider-Man pajamas sprawled crossways along the twin bed. It was only recently that he took to sleeping on his own, and that was certainly not her choice or his. "It's time," her husband had announced to their son, wanting his wife to share their bed with only him again. "You are a big boy now. You're going to be going to school full-time soon. You don't need your mama to protect you from the dark." The very next day, Johnny tumbled from the tree. No, it wasn't the dark that was the problem, but rather the false security of daylight. Hilda preferred the night hours, anything from twilight on. In darkness and in sleep, there were no rules, no orders. Daylight meant obeying. It meant schedules and rations. Hilda remembered the years of bringing sandwiches stuffed with potatoes to school because meat was needed for the brave soldiers. And so her mother, wanting to give her more than dry bread, added potatoes, leftovers from the main meal from the day before. Large houses were divided and roomers were allotted. Hilda could not think of a time when there weren't old men and lonely women on the third floor or in the attic. There had been a woman who helped with peeling the potatoes who always wore an apron.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?